You're listening to Uniquely Beautiful Stories with Heather McAneer, a place for you to find encouragement to fully live your uniquely beautiful life.
Hi, friends, and welcome back to the Uniquely Beautiful Stories podcast. I'm your host, Heather McAneer, and I'm so glad you're tuning in. I want to thank you for joining us each week in this space as we bring you stories of redemption and beauty in hopes that you will find encouragement to go out and fully live your own uniquely beautiful story. I have to let you know that our podcast is brought to you by Cedar Creek Dental Associates. If you're near the Oklahoma City area looking for quality dental care, be sure to check out their website at okcsmile.com. I promise you'll find an amazing staff and top-notch dental care to keep you smiling for years to come. Well, guys, I'm so excited to bring you today's interview. It's with a beautiful woman that I've had the privilege of watching Lauren Green McAfee grow up. For those of you who aren't familiar with Lauren, she's a speaker, a writer, and a coffee enthusiast. She works for Hobby Lobby as a corporate ambassador, and she's pursuing her PhD at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Lauren and her husband, Michael, live in Oklahoma City, and they've been married for 9 years. That's crazy to believe.
I can't believe it's been that long.
So I've known you since before you and Michael were married.
That's right. Yeah. I started coming to Council Road when I was 7 years old.
Oh, so my goodness.
Over 20 years.
That's crazy. And I've been there just about 20 years. So basically been at the same church for a really long time. Kind of watched you and Michael's budding romance.
Yes.
So when did you guys meet?
Yeah. So Michael and I met when I came to the church when I was 7. So
oh, my goodness.
I really, in Sunday school, was when we met. We were the same age and grade, so I really don't remember life before I knew Michael, because we just always grew up around each other. We never went to the same schools, but we were always in the same church, and we became really good friends in middle school and just kind of stayed friends.
Oh, so friends first.
Yes.
And then when did, I'm sure it was like a matter of when your parents would let you date, probably. You know, when did that all kind of go to the next step?
So we kind of became best friends in middle school, and then in high school, I would be interested in him, but he'd kind of shy away from it, and then he'd be interested in me, and I'd be like, no, we don't want to mess up the friendship, or I like someone else. And
yes.
Whenever we were in juniors in high school, our mutual close friend, Casey Yates, was Casey Banks at that time, was hearing Michael talk to Casey about how much he liked me, and I was talking to Casey about how much I liked him, and she was like, you guys just need to talk.
She's stuck in the middle.
Yeah. So
I love it.
So eventually, the summer after our junior year of high school, we started dating after a couple months of just praying and kind of just thinking intentionally about, we had been such good friends that it was like, okay, like this is, we'll change things. We don't want to mess up our friendship.
Right.
For something that doesn't matter. So
yeah,
prayed about it, talked to some mentors, and then, started quote unquote dating, whatever that means when you're 17.
Right.
It was a lot of group hangouts and just hanging out around each other whenever we were with friends. And then, dated for 4 years before we got married.
Wow.
It's hard to get married quickly whenever you're 17 years old and
right.
start dating.
Right. Well, but I think probably, having the history that you did helped you guys to be pretty intentional from the start, because it was like, we don't want to mess up our friendship and just have, heartbreak. But then it's almost like when you're 17 and you're thinking, am I thinking about marriage? Because that seems kind of far off, too,
So it was that weird tension of, we wanted to be intentional and not just date to date, but also realize, we're 17.
Right.
So if we're going to be, going out or dating or whatever, we just wanted to keep it lighthearted while we were so young.
Yes.
And it wasn't until we were in college that we decided to be, hanging out more on, dates instead of just hanging out in groups.
Yes.
We were really intentional about the pace that we dated, since we knew we were young. And if it was going to lead to marriage, then we probably needed to wait.
Yeah, take it slow.
At least a few years.
Exactly. So. And y'all went to the same college, right?
We did. We didn't actually expect to end up at the same school.
Huh.
Whenever we were seniors, we were both looking at separate private schools, Christian schools.
Mm-hmm.
And in kind of the same month, a few months before we graduated, we both ended up kind of switching and going to OU. Fairly independent of each other. And so, we both went to the University of Oklahoma, and absolutely loved it. We had a great experience there. Oh,
and dated. Did you guys wait until after college, or did y'all marry while you were still in college?
We got married when we were still in college. Okay. So we were 20 years old when we got engaged. We were juniors in college. And got married a few weeks before we started our senior year of college. Okay. So Michael started as a business major. Okay. And I started as a psychology major. And we both, in the second semester at school, switched to being letters majors.
How so funny.
We had the same major, and then we both ended up getting the same minor.
So oh, my goodness.
Our classes, the junior and senior years of our schooling, were most of the same classes, so we'd go to class together.
Wow.
And then the senior year, we were married, so we went to all the same classes.
That's
and,
so fun.
Yeah, we had one teacher that thought it was very weird that we were married.
Really?
Because, you know, y'all were just young, not that many people.
Yeah.
As 21-year-olds and in college, were married. So he was like, this is the first time I've ever had a married couple in one of my classes.
Wow.
So, yeah, he thought it was very funny.
See, I feel like I went to a small private Christian college where I had multiple friends that got married, you know, midway through college. And so to me, I feel like...
Because of Christian culture, whereas this was a large secular state school.
Yeah.
So I didn't even have friends that were seriously dating whenever we got married. I had like one friend that had just gotten into a serious relationship whenever I... was engaged, and everyone else was single.
So it was just seemed like the opposite extreme.
Yeah.
What did you guys think that you would do with the letters major, or what was your, at that time, like what was your thought, your future plan?
Great question. So yeah, letters is a classics degree that focuses on history, literature, and philosophy. And so Michael wanted to be a pastor. He had wanted to be a pastor since he was in second grade. And I just wanted to work for my family's business, and I didn't actually think I needed a degree. Mm-hmm. I was just kind of in school to delay having to go to work full time, and thought that the subjects were interesting. I was interested in history and philosophy, and then I got a minor in religious studies. And so I really just picked it because I was like, yeah, that sounds neat. Like, didn't have any career aspirations.
Yeah, it's a little of everything.
Yeah, I just kind of thought it'd be fun and with what I wanted to do, what I thought I wanted to do, just kind of go on into the family business. Yeah. I didn't actually technically need a degree because no one in my family had graduated from college before me. So I was the first person in my family to ever graduate.
I didn't realize that.
An undergraduate degree. Yeah, so my parents didn't. My grandparents on either side didn't. So
wow.
Yeah, so it was kind of, in my mind, it was like, oh, I guess college is a thing that I'll do for a little bit just to try it out.
Yeah.
But didn't know if I'd even actually finish, but did actually graduate with a degree with history, literature, and philosophy. So.
Well, and then, you are from a big family. You can speak to a little bit of your upbringing of it. I'm just wondering, you know, being from a big family, and then I know you were homeschooled for part of and then Christian school. Like, I'm wondering how much of that affected what you just kind of thought your future would hold.
Yeah, I loved, so I'm one of six kids, loved having all of those siblings, and two of my sisters are really close to me in age, and then I have an older brother, and then I have two sisters that are still really young, one's still in high school, and one's in middle school. And growing up with a lot of kids and being homeschooled and just getting to hang out with each other. And I remember my mom telling us we had to be friends with our siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of like, that doesn't like make sense. Like, I don't like, I get it. They're my siblings. So like, I have friends. But now as an adult, I realized why she was really constantly forcing us to really work through our conflicts. She would have us sit on this bench and work through our issues if we were in a fight with each other until we kind of figured it out. And now I'm so grateful because my sisters are my best friends and love having lots of siblings. So, yeah, I kind of grew up just in this awesome experience with being homeschooled and then going to a Christian school for high school and figured that I would similarly just kind of work in the family business and then have a family and kids of my own someday. Mm-hmm. And things were working out for that, I guess, in my mind, whenever I actually got a college degree. I was so proud of myself. I didn't even expect for me to do that.
And did you go straight into working at the family business?
Yes. Okay. And then went straight into working in the business. So I had worked in the Hobby Lobby store in Norman during school for the last couple of years, worked part-time. And then started working at the corporate office whenever I finished school and was married. And my husband, Michael, was working in ministry. And
yes.
Yeah, it was great.
And then what? I know from the outside, it's easy. I have this like spoiler in my mind because I know how your life has played out. But it's definitely, yeah. I would assume it's played out really differently than
very differently.
21-year-old Lauren would have thought.
Yeah, 21-year-old Lauren was like, okay, like I'm married to a pastor. I'm passionate about serving alongside him in the church. I am, you know, just doing my thing, working at a desk job very administratively in the family business. And, yeah, figured we'd wait a couple of years and then have some kids. But that is not how it's played out. So, I think it's whenever you're young, we always have these expectations of what our life is going to look like. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, fast forward 9 years, I'm 30, looking back at, you know, 20, 21-year-old Lauren, seeing the expectations I had of what my life would look like is not at all what it is today, but it doesn't mean that it's not good and beautiful. But it does take kind of grieving the expectations that you had and kind of the dreams you had for yourself, but also realizing the great joy in the unexpected blessings that come along in that. So yeah, I've been pretty open about my husband and I's experience with infertility, and we're 9 years married and still no kids, and it actually, whenever we got married, so my youngest sister is adopted, and so I've always been passionate about adoption. My sister works in the field of adoption as a social worker, and my brother is a foster parent, so it's very much just kind of in the ethos of our family. It's just this passion for orphan care. So whenever my husband and I got married, we knew that we, you know, desired for that to be a part of our story. So we started pursuing adoption 5 years ago, and we also started trying to have children biologically 3 years ago and still have no children. So it's just interesting to look back and see that, all, you know, kind of the idea that we had of starting this family and him being in a church and me doing the family thing with work just... They've played out in different ways, but with kids, it's just not, it hasn't happened on our timeline. And so that's something that, like I mentioned, you just have to kind of be able to grieve the loss of that expectation, that dream, and trust that God has a plan in the midst of all of it, because it can be really difficult whenever you have such a longing for something and no hope if it'll ever happen. And then trusting that anything can happen with God. So
it is that's a balance there of living in the reality of now, but not losing your hope for the future, not letting your past experience, you know, color that and make you resentful or jaded towards your future. Do you have any practical thoughts on like how you keep your heart hopeful, or how you keep yourself from falling into, you know, despair or real negative thinking?
Yeah. So my favorite verse for this season that I keep going back to, and I don't remember the exact verse, but in Hebrews 12, Christ says that it's for the joy before him that he endured the cross, which can sound very strange when you think about enduring the cross, which was a very brutal way to die, and that Christ endured that with joy because he knew what was on the other side of that cross, which was the ability for each of us to have relationship with God through his perfect sacrifice that paid, that his death paid for my sin and for all of our sin. So he paid the debt that I couldn't pay myself and that he didn't owe, so that I might have relationship with God and forgiveness and freedom. So when I think about Christ being able to have joy, it's not because of what he had to endure on the cross, but it's because of what was on the other side of it. And as Christians, we each have that same hope on the other side of this life. We know that we have heaven with God. And so whatever we experience in this life can be used to hopefully make our hearts more like God and allow those sufferings and the trials and the difficult things to shape us to be more like him, but also hopefully to point others toward him. And so there's great joy. In James, it says, consider it pure joy, my brothers, when you face trials of many kinds. Because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. And so that grows perseverance in us, but also allows us an opportunity to use those stories to share of God's goodness and his hope and his joy when it doesn't make sense to have that joy. So
Yeah, absolutely. I love that perspective so much. And recently your husband, Michael, was preaching at Council Road, and I remember him talking about making some points that I thought were really mature and really profound, but he talked about the fact that you guys have kind of had to go through a process of almost picturing what might not ever be and being able to kind of let it go. And he just gave a long list of things like weddings and crying babies in the night. And, you know, he just gave a really precious list of things. And I felt like it was kind of an emotional moment to picture you guys having to almost let go. But it's not just walking around with this, like, well, poor us, we're never going to get to do this. But it's like embracing what you have instead right now. And it doesn't diminish the fact that you still desire that and that you're probably still going to keep praying and asking for a really long time for that. But I see the two of you living this picture of you're living fully with 2 feet in where you are. And I admire that so much, rather than wallowing in what could have been and what is happening for some of your friends. But yet I see you guys just fully embracing where God has you. I'd love for you to speak a little to that, how you've just been able to do that, and even some of those fun things that God has brought. I can say fun, even though it's like a bittersweet, you know, kind of fun.
Yeah, no, absolutely fun, for sure. Yeah, you know, exactly like what you said. Like, there is this grieving of, you know, I want to see Michael as a father and thought that I would have by now in my life. And all the things that come with that, and watching him teach our children how to ride their bikes and taking them to church and watching them learn to take their first steps. And you know, we still have hope that that might be a part of our story someday, but it's been years of constant disappointment. But with that, we do want to be intentional with what God has for our lives right now. We know that he's in control, and that brings a lot of rest in our current circumstances. And it's good to allow ourselves to grieve those, the loss of those hopes and expectations, to at the end of the day know that God has a plan that is bigger than ours, and that can give us the peace that we long for. So it's been healthy for us to grieve that and talk with friends and just be sad about it. And but then what gives us that hope is, like what we said earlier, just kind of knowing that God has the plan. And so with that, that means, you know, we're not tied down with kids right now. And even though that's what we want to be experiencing, we have had incredible opportunities. We got to live in New York City for a year and just moved back here about a half ago. Yeah.
Like, I told y'all that when you moved, I was like, just P.S. I'm living vicariously through you in my favorite city.
Yes. It was like, I never expected for that to be a part of our story at all. But, and it wouldn't have probably happened if we had kids.
Yeah.
But absolutely loved it and grew so much and got to travel a whole lot because of work, traveled together. And then today, doing different jobs than we expected to be in, but committed to those, and then both being in school.
And you guys have both continued your education. So you graduated from OU, both of you, and then educationally, where did that lead from there?
So I was surprised I even got one degree, let alone would continue to pursue it. But yeah, right after we graduated with our undergrad, we both started into seminary master's programs. So Michael got a master's of divinity from Southern Seminary, and I got a master's in counseling from Liberty Seminary, and then I got a master's in theological studies for lay leadership from Southern Seminary.
Wow.
And then, yeah, today we're just finishing up our first year of being in a PhD program, which we have a paper due this week. You see Michael and I, and we look like we're tired and stressed out, it's because we're finishing up our papers, so we are.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. But I mean, did you ever dream that you guys would be Dr. and Dr. McAfee?
No, not at all. Yeah, we never expected it, but it's been fun. So we are in the same PhD program.
Okay.
So we go to class together. We have the same PhD supervisor.
Oh, wow.
So we're both writing a paper for the same class right now on different topics. It's been really fun. We've loved how, because of just the circumstances we have, our lives have really collided in the same path in many ways, not only with our undergraduate, but with our PhDs being the same degree. And we were both just passionate about it and worked out the same, but then also getting to work together for a few years in the kind of the same area of work and travel together for work was a lot of fun. So we just like being together.
Yeah. Which is a very good thing.
Yeah. So
that is so unusual though for husbands and wives. I mean, such a fun blessing for you guys.
It's been great.
I mean, I have to know though, I'm picturing like being in the same classes and writing the same papers. Like, do you get grades in PhD?
Yes.
So like, do you guys have any conflict or compare your grades
or
that create tension?
So we are pretty competitive. But it actually kind of helps because it spurs us both on to try harder than we might if we were doing it on our own.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've figured out how to be okay with one of us doing better grade wise. And it goes back and forth.
Okay.
So, it's pretty, neck and neck kind of on this. Yeah. So sometimes him, sometimes it's me. So
I could, cause I mean, the chance that you would get the exact same grade is pretty slim.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's just obviously one of you is going to score a point or two higher and you just got to go with it. Well,
it's so great.
I can only imagine that because, when we first got married, we played a lot of Scrabble with each other.
Nice.
And we finally had to stop because one... someone kept winning and someone else didn't respond very well. And
so
finally
funny.
I was like, what started out as being like a fun thing for marriage, just you know,
didn't,
we were too competitive.
Yeah.
So I'm picturing.
Yeah, there are games that I won't play with Michael because I know he's very good at strategy games. And I'm just kind of like, I don't care. So I'm not a good loser. So there are some games we just won't play together. So, yeah.
It's hard.
We just
but
have to
I,
figure out how to work together, though.
Well, and I'm sure that's just been, like, I mean, that's a make it or break it kind of thing. Like, if you're going to be in the same program with the same classes and the same professors, you're just going to
have to
realize that.
Yeah.
And thankfully, it goes back and forth, and it's not just one of you, like, killing it, and the other one's, like, struggling to keep a B, you know?
Yeah. And it's so funny, because we have different ways that we accomplish things, so... he will take a lot of time to really externally process things, and I'm an internal processor, and so he'll want to talk about, you know, this is what I'm going to write about, and this is, you know, what do you think about this, and I'm just like, I just need to sit and write, like, I don't need to talk to you, I just need to go.
Yes.
So well, it's like figuring out how to work with each other and be, you know, be willing to listen to him at times and give him the feedback, even though I'm thinking, like, I don't really need to listen to this. I just need to work.
Oh, right.
But then also him realizing, okay, like, maybe I can just externally process this to myself.
Right.
And
in another room.
Go work. Yeah. So, yeah, it's figuring out how we each work. And that really helped kind of have grace for each other and try and compromise and help each other out.
Oh, I can totally see that. Well, and I'm wondering now that you mention it, like, he's externally processing, and obviously you're not going to write about the exact same thing in your paper. So for me, I'd be like, wait, I don't need all these extra thoughts because I had a track I was going on.
Yes. And now I have like other ideas because you said,
So then it would be, for me, it would be trickier to like rein it back into my original.
For our dissertations, we've kind of had that happen. So we're in the coursework phase, which means for the first 2 years of our PhD program, you go to classes and you write papers. Shorter papers for that class, like 25 pages.
So short.
And then, and then you have a couple years after that where you're writing a dissertation, which is like over 150 page paper about a particular topic in depth. You research and then contribute new ideas to that topic.
Yeah.
So for our dissertation, we've both kind of ended up talking ourselves into kind of the same type of focus that we want to have, but with like slightly different emphasis.
Yes.
And so we've had to have those, okay, we can't be like doing the same paper.
Right.
We have to have these differences.
Because would your advisor be like, we've already got someone doing this and it's your husband.
Exactly.
So, right.
Yeah.
You've got to be different
enough.
Can't be
doing the same thing. So it's like, okay, so same template, but different enough concepts that are not going to overlap too much.
Oh, my goodness.
So.
That's a lot to think about.
Yeah, it's been really funny.
I'm sure you guys never have a shortage on things to talk about.
Yeah. Well, unless I'm like, can we not talk so I can get my paper in? But no, it's
true.
A lot of fun. We love getting to... So it's mostly online. We go to class 1 week a semester and the rest is done at home. And so it's nice to still have that classmate interaction of getting to discuss the things
that's
that we're reading Otherwise, we wouldn't have that.
Yeah, that's true. Other students probably feel like they're just all alone.
Yeah.
You know, processing it all, and you've got a built-in classmate in your house.
It's great. It's really fun.
Now, do you both, I know you're a corporate ambassador for Hobby Lobby. I'd love to kind of hear what that entails. And then also, what is he doing job-wise right now?
Yeah. So corporate ambassador for Hobby Lobby is, I've done that for the past almost 2 years now. And so I get to do communications, both internal and external, for the company, which has been a lot of fun. And getting to just learn new things and figure out how to be a managing editor for the newsletter that happens internally in the company, and then creating the articles that go on the newsroom for all the stores that are opening. Because Hobby Lobby opens about 60 stores a year.
Wow.
So almost, more than averaging one a week.
Oh my goodness.
So yeah, so we put the information about the opening stores on a newsroom. So
that's neat.
Yeah, so that's been really fun. And with Michael, he is working full-time at Museum of the Bible, doing Bible engagement projects with a lot of nonprofits and churches.
Oh, wow.
And, I used to work at Museum of the Bible as well. That's where I started for 6 years. And so that's where we kind of had the overlapping.
Okay, with travel.
Getting to work together within the travel. Yeah. And I worked at Museum of the Bible for the first few years that it started before Michael came on board. Michael was working full-time in church, at our church, as a pastor. He was a youth pastor and then the young adult pastor.
That's right.
So whenever he transitioned kind of from being full-time on staff at a church to working at Museum of the Bible, I had the hardest time with that because it was such an identity thing for me to be a pastor's or a church staff member's wife.
Yeah, okay.
And I absolutely loved that. My husband has always, since he was 7 years old, said he wanted to be a pastor. Mm-hmm.
And is that still a dream of his?
And yeah, he still is very passionate about the church and teaching, but God has called him into this work in a nonprofit role at Museum of the Bible. And so it really threw both of us off whenever we started to feel like that's where God was leading. And so whenever Michael was kind of really like, you know, I think that this is the direction I'm going to go, I had to really process through my own identity and grieve the loss of the expectation I had that I was just going to be, you know, like a pastor's wife and that was part of who I was. And yeah, so it was a really weird transition, but he still gets to teach at our church.
Yes.
And so he's a teaching pastor in the rotation and absolutely loves that. And he's so gifted at it.
Yes.
And yeah, he gets to work at the museum now, which has been a lot of fun. And I'm so grateful too, now looking back, that we had those years of overlap. Because that was definitely a very unique season. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So does your job with Hobby Lobby ever like cross over anymore with the museum, or are they pretty separate now?
Every once in a while, a few times a year, I'll have the opportunity to go speak at something and get to share about the museum. And so I'm working alongside some of the museum team members, which is really fun. So it's nice that I still get to be involved a little bit in that because I was with the museum for the first 6 years that it existed. I started as one of the first employees. And so, it was really neat to just kind of see it grow from the ground up.
Right.
And so I'm glad I still get to, be involved a little bit.
Absolutely. I can imagine feeling like you were kind of part of it when it was a baby and launching it into the world. And then if you had no connection anymore, it was more hands-off, it would probably feel really
feel very weird.
Strange. Yeah. So now at least you still have, like, your husband is there. So you're really on the, you're still
I still get to hear about it all the time. My sister works for Museum of the Bible as well in the D.C. office.
Okay.
So, I get to hear about how it's going in D.C. as well, which is really fun. It's just such an incredible, exciting project that no one in my family ever really saw coming. Hmm. It was one of those things that we just kept walking in obedience the next step. And then a couple years down the road, we were realizing we really feel like God is calling this to be a museum. And he's opening the doors for it to be in Washington, D.C. Like this, we kind of thought it'd be a smaller thing in Dallas eventually. But now it's in Washington, D.C. It's like a 12-minute walk from the U.S. Capitol to the museum.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's, 8-story building. It's,
It's
the third largest museum in D.C.
Oh, my goodness.
Like over 50 museums in D.C.
Yeah.
So
we still haven't been, but it's on our family travel plan.
Yeah,
so, I just read a statistic the other day. I'm not just putting you on the spot. I'm sure you know this, but a statistic of how many people have been through it in just the short time it's been open.
Yeah, over 600,000 people have gone through the museum in the 7 months that it's been open.
It's so crazy that it hasn't even been a year.
Over 500,000, which is really exciting to just see that Yeah, people are going and really enjoying it. We've done an exit survey when people leave the museum and asking kind of what is the feel or the word that you have leaving after you've experienced the Museum of the Bible. And the most common word was hope.
Oh, wow.
Which was not what I expected.
No, me neither. That's so encouraging.
So encouraging. Yeah, that caught me off guard and I almost like just got chills because I was like, wow, that's something that's significant.
Yes.
It's really important.
That's what you would want to give to people.
So it's such a joy to see people walking through and enjoying the museum. And I can't believe I got to be a small, tiny, tiny part of it.
So yeah, I mean, even just that is like so much of what I see in your story is, you know, we've talked about 21-year-old Lauren had, you know, we all, no matter what age we're at, have such a limited view of what's coming, but we all kind of write some type of a script in our head that we just think is around the corner. And even just these things you've mentioned, like travel and speaking places and living in New York City, being a part of like a museum from the ground up. I mean,
that crazy stuff. I never would have written that for me, but you know, God has the big picture, and that's what's so promising and comforting is that I know God knows the rest of what my steps are too. And so whenever I get overwhelmed with worrying about, you know, what if this never does work out or what if such and such happens, it's, you know, I know that God has the full picture and he knows the path that he has for me and he'll use it for his good.
Yeah.
And so, it gives a lot of comfort to have that perspective.
Yeah. Absolutely. What would you tell a woman if there was someone sitting in here with us who was kind of in her own season of disappointment? And I'm sure it wouldn't look like yours because all of our stories are unique. Yeah. But whatever it is that she had been hoping and praying for, and she's just not seeing that happening. I know you can identify with that.
Yeah. I think that whenever we do face disappointments in our life, it's so important to realize why. So for me, I like to process through things so that I can understand, you know, why I'm experiencing either a sadness or whatever the emotion is. And so figuring out why I feel the disappointment, which for me was helpful in realizing that I had an expectation and that, you know, that's why I feel this way is because that expectation's not being met. And knowing that it's okay to be sad about not having that expectation and to have the disappointment. There's an app called Glide, and so we like video chat each other. It's kind of like Voxer.
Yeah.
But you know, it's, you know, getting to talk just with the people that are close to you. So for me, it's often with my sisters about just the disappointments and the emotion with that. And then to have someone that can show empathy, I think is really powerful. And so my sisters and my friends do a really good job of that, of being willing to have empathy and just allow you to just be and just realize, you know, this is not what I wanted. This is not what I expected. This is a disappointment, and that's okay. And then in the right timing to just point towards the hope and a reminder that things are in God's hands, and that doesn't mean always just throwing out a verse at someone as soon as they're expressing those disappointments, be like, you know what, it's gonna be fine, like, read this Bible verse. It's like, no, like, it's okay, like, that is tough, and to recognize that, but eventually to lead to the truth, because that does give hope.
It does.
The truth of Scripture does give great hope and great joy and peace and comfort. And realizing that people in the Bible went through seasons of lament.
Yeah.
My friend Esther Fleece wrote a book about just kind of the study of the theology of lament in the Bible, and that you read the Psalms and obviously see individuals that did lament and have just honest disappointment expressed before the Lord, and that that's okay. And then also in the same book, you see them move to chapters of great joy and even dancing before the Lord with joy, even though maybe a few chapters earlier there was great sorrow and disappointment. And that, I think, is a beautiful just book in the Bible that can show us, you know, God created us with emotions. It's okay to feel those.
Yeah.
And it's okay to express those. And then we realize that we can always find, but come back to that hope and the joy and the comfort that comes from God.
What's the name of her book?
No More Faking Fine.
Okay, good.
Which I love the title.
I do too.
Yeah, Esther Fleece, No More Faking Fine. It's a great book.
Okay, I'll put a link to any scriptures that we've referenced and any books or anything. I'll put it in the notes to the show because I know listeners will want to check back with things.
It's a great book. Her story is amazing.
That's awesome. I'm glad that you mentioned that as far as like the timing and just being gentle with people's pain and disappointment, because I do think for whatever reason, especially in Christian culture, it's just really easy for people to almost brush past your pain to try to either fix it or give you an encouraging scripture. And like you said, I mean, scripture does bring hope and healing. And honestly, for me, when I'm ready, there's no words that can comfort my heart like scripture can and truly get me in a place of hope. I can read a great article, but if it's not founded on truth, you know, it'll be nice thoughts. But to actually feel like healing in my bones comes from scripture. But there's a time and a place. And when someone is, you know, pouring their heart out to you and sharing their disappointment or their loss or their grief, I just love that you pointed out to just sit with them in that and be a friend and show empathy and, you know, hug or cry with them or whatever. Like, be a real person, like, skin on to love them through it. And you can't always fix it. And you might not even have a scripture to say at that moment. But then later, God will put something on your heart to text back. But I think there's nothing that makes us feel less known and heard than when someone tries to just push past our hurt and wrap it up quickly. You know, you just feel...
That's a great summary. Yeah, it's not always going to have the bow tied up nice and pretty at the end of one conversation. I think that you're right, in Christian culture, and kind of it's easy to, as Christians, want it to be that way and to think like, oh, well, like, we have Jesus, so everything should just be wrapped up with a smile. You read the Bible and you see so often, almost always, not the case right away. There is the opportunity for the journey through the mess. And so I think it's difficult to wade into that with others because we want to be able to control situations or make things better or, you know, fix things, but it's just not life. And so we get to figure out how to wade through the difficulties together and try to be the encouragement that we can by pointing to truth in the right moments.
Well, and then our hearts are just vulnerable to be opened wide when we truly want to enter into someone's pain with them. You know, I've had that opportunity to walk some really tough things with friends, and I think that is something that happens, is when you're truly walking it with them, I mean, your heart feels raw and vulnerable, and in a way, the Lord allows you to feel their pain and carry their burden with them, which is very uncomfortable, but it's such an intimate and special place that, if I'm sure you've experienced this, you know, a time or two, because you've lived life and you've got a lot of dear friends, but once God allows you to do that and you literally enter into someone's pain with him, there's a bond that you can never break. And there's a depth to that friendship because you have gone to the hard places. And a lot of times we just... I mean, we're pain avoiders, you know.
We are. Yeah, it's odd how that just is constant. We always like to avoid the pain. But yeah, no, you're right. It's such an honor, I think, whenever people allow me into those and have the vulnerability to allow me into the journey. And so while it can be, I mean, for me, it can be, I'll get like nervous about having the right thing to say. And how can I, you know, have the right encouragement or say the right thing. And so it's, you know, I have to set that aside and just remind myself being there is what's important. And then just allowing the Holy Spirit to kind of work through this situation. And then, I'm always very honored when people allow me into the difficult scenarios of other people's lives. Whenever my husband and I first started sharing openly about our infertility experience, we kind of both just felt that, you know, we wanted to share our story in hopes of it encouraging other people. Infertility is a lot more common than people expect. 1 in 8 couples experiencing infertility. And so there are, you know, still unreported cases. So that's a lot of people. I mean, that's a number of people in the country that are walking this path. And so knowing that, we wanted to share so that hopefully other people that are walking the same path will see that they're not alone. Mm-hmm. And so we, in that, have had so many people come up and tell us their story of infertility. And it's always such an honor whenever people trust us with their own path of disappointment and discouragement. And always neat, too, to see how God has, for some couples that are, you know, years past that experience or are further down the road in their life and can look back and point to, you know, how God used it, it's always an encouragement, too.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure because of where you are in life with friends and people starting families, I would guess that's been kind of a hard tension to live in where you're desperately wanting one of your own and then you're also celebrating with the people that you love. How have you maneuvered that?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And I do think that the answer is different for each person. Uh-huh. So with my husband and I, we were really just stepping into loving the role of being, you know, honorary aunt and uncle Lauren and Michael to so many of these kids that our friends have. And most of my friends are on to their second child now. Almost all my friends have at least one child now. And we get together and still hang out with our friends, and they have all these kids running around, and so we get to enjoy them and just try and be, you know, a fun honorary aunt and uncle. And then I have, you know, my brother has four kiddos too, and a foster daughter, and so they're so much fun. So yeah, it's trying to love on our friends and figure out how to be friends. I think relationship with friends pre-kid and post-kid is so different.
So true.
And we didn't know that, you know, it completely changed.
You didn't know to expect
makes sense. You are adding, like, another human being to the equation of the friendship. So, we've had to figure out, like, what does that look like to be friends with, you know, other couples that have one or two or three kids, and hanging out with them looks different. They can't just, like, spur of the moment go see a movie.
Stay out late.
Like, includes a babysitter if we're going somewhere. So, it's, you know, it's having grace and again, just being willing to shift the expectation of what the friendship might look like. And figure out how to have a new normal, which, you know, is, I feel like, all of life, you know. Nothing's ever going to always stay the same. We just always have to be figuring out how to have a new normal.
That's true.
But, you know, for some friends I've had that have walked in infertility, it means sometimes not being able to go to the baby shower because it's just too heartbreaking. And it means having to have certain boundaries. I had one friend who, any time that she would go into a grocery store and she saw a mother with small kiddos, would just start crying. And, you know, it's a very difficult thing to grieve, the longing for children and not being able to have that. And so we each process that differently. And so I think, too, it's having grace for... So if you know someone that is walking into fertility, it's having grace for them and realizing that they may not process grief the same way that you would, or that another person that you know that has experienced the same thing would, and that it's going to look differently. And so we have to figure out how to be a friend alongside each other, depending on how that grieving process looks like. So it takes a lot of grace.
Do you think it would be a wise conversation to have, obviously, if it's a close friend, not just someone random, but if a dear friend of yours is experiencing infertility and you're in the place where you're having a family, do you think that would be a good conversation just to say, how can I help you? And are there any triggers that you have or anything that...
Absolutely. You know? Yeah. I think that it's a great thing to bring up just the conversation of, you know, how do you want our friendship to look? What are the triggers? Is it helpful if I'm asking every so often? Is it, you know, what are the things that are helpful and what are the things that aren't helpful? And just having that honest conversation. And the person that is experiencing the infertility will just appreciate that you care enough and that you recognize enough that there is that pain and loss there enough to care to step into that and be a good friend. So absolutely.
Even if it's not infertility, even if it, I think about even like with a death, I have a couple friends who have lost someone dear to them. And I know that they say even just mentioning that person's name, bringing them up, like, I think as the person who's trying to be careful, you feel like, I don't want to bring it up and make them sad. And it's almost like the elephant in the room. But I've had friends that have said, well, it's already on my mind. It's constantly here. And so when we talk about it, it actually feels comforting to know that everyone else is aware of this. And
and it validates that feeling of sadness or grief. Yes. Yeah. No, absolutely. And I And this kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier, but Michael, in his sermon, was kind of shared in one of his sermons about our experience with infertility.
Yeah.
And also made the suggestion to people that if they are in scenarios, it can, you would be amazed how many people ask, one of the first things they do when they meet me is, are you married? Oh, how many kids do you have? Or why did you have kids? Or when are you having kids? And it's like, if it's someone I'm just meeting, I'm probably not going to right into. Although, I've kind of started doing that now. I'm like, yeah, like, we wanted kids. We just haven't been able
to. Yeah.
Just whatever. If the opportunity is right, just being open about it. But yeah, it can be, on some instances, you may not always try to assume things or ask questions like that. But then, yeah, with, like, friends,
with the dear
you
friends,
want to talk about that. Yeah, because they're the people that are your people, so you should be talking to
And you're
going to
be in community. You want to make sure you don't say something that sounds highly insensitive and you're not even meaning it, you know. Yeah. I loved his list. It was almost like the don'ts, like things not to do. And can you think of a couple of those on the top of your head?
Well, another one that I was thinking of, too, was that so many times whenever we have shared our story, people will say, oh, I knew this, a friend who had a cousin that was infertile, and now they have 10 kids, so I'm sure it'll work out, or, you know.
And that almost sounds dismissive, like we were talking about earlier, it doesn't validate your pain.
The pain and the longing that we don't experience right now. I had another person who heard, and like, oh, but, you know, that's okay if you can't have kids, you can still adopt. And it's like, well, yes, That is true, and that's always been a part of the plan, was adoption for our family. That's not for everyone's. But that doesn't make the fact that we still long for biological children go away.
Right.
And so that is, even through adoption and the beautiful thing that adoption is, even for people that do have that path, you still have to grieve the loss of the ability to have biological children.
Child.
So it is very dismissive of that as well. So so I would encourage people not to be dismissive, but to recognize the difficulty. And there are some instances where it's great to share those hope stories where people have had the nice bow that did come at the end of the story.
Yeah.
But not everyone's story is going to be that way.
Yeah.
And the point isn't to have all of our earthly desires fulfilled. That's not what we want to point people towards in order to have hope.
Mm.
Our hope is in knowing God and that He's working all things for our good and that we get to live this life to glorify Him. Mm. So Michael's point, we recognize why people are trying to provide the picture of what it could look like when those desires are met.
Yes.
But as Christians, it's not about having our earthly desires met. As Christians, it's about how am I glorifying God through whatever circumstances I have, and how can people point me towards that?
Yeah.
So it's just a different kind of mindset.
It is. And it almost, honestly, as you talk about that, it makes the whole, like, having kids, or for someone who's been single forever longing for a husband, getting married, you know, whatever that, it makes that the idol. Like, it makes that the end game. And so when we try to fill someone with hope that someday you'll get married, you're a wonderful person, or God will allow you to have kids, like, you're right. That actually is stealing the glory from God. And it's and it's also just imagining a plan for that person's life that we don't know. Like you said at the beginning of this conversation, God's writing a story for you. And if you can lean into where you are now, you can see that that story is so different and even in some ways better than you would have imagined.
Yeah.
But when we just dismiss it, like, I'm sure you'll get pregnant soon, or an adoption will work out, like, it really is like idolizing that fulfillment over the life that God is actually giving you right now.
Exactly. Yeah. No, you're exactly
and then we,
right.
you know, we set our sights on the wrong things, and we all, I mean, I think that's what we constantly, no matter what the fill in the blank is, like, we all are constantly doing that, like, setting aside whatever it is that's stealing our focus and our attention from Christ, you know?
Yeah.
But I do love that how you guys, you cling to the hope of heaven. And obviously that's hugely important to our daily life, but I think you keep a really good perspective of the here and now. God has left us here to live a life that He's given us.
Yeah, that's right.
And so I think keeping the hope of heaven in proper perspective, but also, like, embracing what He's doing. And this is a great lead-in. I didn't plan it, but you have actually written a really great book. So something super fun I want to talk about. You and your mom got to write a book.
Yes, we did. So crazy.
It's just so fun. I'm sure let's just add that to the list of things you never thought you'd say.
Never thought I would say. Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, it just launched a couple weeks ago. And so, yeah, brand new first-time author. But exactly what you're saying, like, we do have the opportunity in the here and now, regardless of our circumstances, to mm-hmm. really shape an impact for the world that will last in eternity. Mm-hmm. And so we each have the opportunity to look at our own life, our own circumstances, our giftings, where God has placed us, and say, how can I be going about my day today in light of a long-term legacy that I want to shape? And so the book is called Only One Life, How a Woman's Everyday Shapes an Eternal Legacy. And so we highlight 36 mini biographies of women who have really made a difference throughout their life by living in light of eternity, but applying that to the everyday. And so in the book, we have 12 chapters, and each chapter has a woman from the Bible, a woman from history, and a woman today.
I love how you set that up.
So, yeah, it's so fun to get to know these women and reading through the book, hopefully they'll feel like your friends and they're in the journey with you of life.
I can attest, I'm not all the way through it, but I have read, I've launched into it and read a good portion, and that's exactly how it feels. It just feels like these women are coming to life, you know. So how, I know it's probably a long story, but in a nutshell, like, how did that even come about that you and your mom, Jackie Green, were like, hey, let's write a book? Like, how did that even come about?
Yeah, so mom and I were both, a couple years ago, traveling for Museum of the Bible and raising awareness. And some of those events for the museum ended up being women's events where we were talking about women and their role in legacy. And so we had seen conversations in our own family around the idea of legacy and wanting to be intentional about investing in kind of a lasting impact. And so the conversation just kind of organically happened that we were having these conversations with other women. And we were so inspired by the stories of women who were doing things in their own communities or making a difference in the people that they knew, that, you know, we thought it'd be fun to just celebrate some of the inspirations that we've gained and celebrate ways that women have had an impact. Sometimes it's easy to think that legacy perhaps is more of a man's thing to create. I think that people can look at legacy and think of monetary things that they leave behind for generations, or possessions that get left behind, or having a building named after you, or a monument in your honor. And we take a different perspective of legacy in looking at what is it that you're investing in that is eternal. So if things are eternal, being God's word, and then human souls. And if we're investing in those eternal things, that's going to have an eternal impact. And so we're invited into this opportunity to work alongside other individuals and allow God to work through us and make a difference in this world. So we just encourage women to be a part of looking at their own life and saying, how is it that I can make a difference right where I'm at? So some of the stories that we highlight are women who were moms, some had careers, one is Queen Elizabeth, some were very poor, single women who never got married or never had kids, but still throughout their life made a difference in the world.
I'm going to put you on the spot. Was there one that just stuck out? I didn't warn you about this question, but as you think back, was there one that you just were like so shocked by that you loved the story?
So probably one of my favorites is a woman named Elizabeth Ann Everest. And I think I like her because most people have never heard of her. But her impact through legacy is still being felt in the world today and people wouldn't realize it. So Elizabeth Ann Everest was single, never married, never had kids of her own, but she, her career was spent as a nanny. And one of the children that she raised was Winston Churchill. She was the nanny for Winston Churchill. Winston's story is really interesting. His parents were alive throughout his life, but they were really never very involved. They sent him off to boarding school. He wrote to them asking them to visit, and they never visited him. It was Elizabeth, his nanny, who would come and visit him. And she invested in him a faith and a conviction and a strength in him that he attributes really to her legacy invested in him. And he obviously became a very significant figure in history and has impacted the Western world as we know it. Well, the whole world as we know it. So he really attributed that, a lot of that legacy to her. And towards the end of his life, on his nightstand, he kept a Bible and a picture of her. And it was, you know, she, whenever she was in the thick of things, just trying to raise, he was apparently very ornery and difficult, which does not surprise me, knowing his personality later in life. But I'm sure that she was thinking, you know, does any of this matter? Right. Like, I'm just trying to keep this kid alive.
Yeah.
But it was her faithfulness to invest in him and breathe life into him by giving him truth and pointing to faith and raising him when his parents, his father was actually very hard on him and really kind of would tell him he didn't think Winston would amount to anything. Mm. But she believed differently in him.
Wow.
And so, yeah, that's a legacy that has had incredible impact.
Absolutely.
And I think it's easy to relate to because there's so often today we can think we're not going to be able to shape an important legacy right. unless we have a platform or, you know, mm-hmm. you write all the books and, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. But it's about being faithful with the everyday yes. mundane things.
Yes, it's the daily.
That really shapes a lasting legacy.
Yeah, it really is. I'm so excited about this book and I'm so proud of you and your mom. I am, because you guys weren't. You know, you didn't, like you said at the beginning of this conversation, yeah. you didn't set out to be a speaker and an author and, yeah, you know, yeah, an ambassador. Yeah. Like, you just, you kind of had just, I guess I would say, normal aspirations.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
God has completely stretched you academically and yes. oh with your gosh. Natural giftings.
Really
and,
stretched.
You know, he's really stretching you, but you are, by leaning into him, you're doing a beautiful job of being
Thank
faithful
you.
With what he's giving you. You
That's
really
so
are.
Kind.
You really are. So I'm going to read a little excerpt from this book because I want our listeners to fall in love with it. And I think that this kind of sums it up. This is in the introduction where I love how you guys, you started it off by talking about your grandma,
yes.
or was it your great-grandma?
Great-grandmother,
yeah. Marie Green. And, oh, I love that. So I won't do any spoilers because I love how you set up her life and you just gave some real fun details about just the mundane, just the daily details mm-hmm. that literally made such a difference for the next generation. So you say, like Marie Green and like so many other women who have gone before us, you only have one life. It is an extraordinary gift from God. Let's learn to use our precious days on earth to make an impact that will last. No matter who you are, no matter what qualifications you feel you have or don't have, we all have a few things in common. We have 24 hours in a day, and we have a desire for God to use our lives for His glory. That's more than enough. So let's be women who get busy doing good with the time that we have. Oh, I think that, oh, that's, for me, that's the heartbeat of this episode. I really hope and pray that the women listening will see, not only from your story, that you've made the most of the life you've been given, and it wasn't the life that you dreamed of as 21-year-old Lauren.
Not at all.
But you've rolled with it. You've trusted God. You've allowed yourself to process it. You weren't, you know, numb and just pushing all your feelings down. You actually have been open with processing your own disappointments. And then I'm also really proud of you and Michael for actually taking that another step and sharing it with other people. Mm. 'Cause I can imagine that that was hard and probably continues to be hard to talk about something so intimate and personal.
Yeah.
But like you said, it's so much more common than we understand. And as you guys are sharing your story, other couples are finding hope.
Mm-hmm. That's what we hope.
And even the couples who haven't struggled with infertility, they're learning, like we talked about today, they're learning how to minister to their friends who are, you know? Mm-hmm. So I kind of feel like everyone wins when we open up our hearts and we share our stories with each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Well, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for spending your time with me today.
Yeah, so fun.
This has been awesome. And I want to point our listeners to you. So the book is found everywhere books are sold, Amazon, Mardell, Hobby Lobby, Lifeway, probably Barnes & Noble,
yeah, exactly.
All the places. And then I know some of our listeners are going to want to connect with you, whether on a personal thing you've talked about or just to follow you and see your fun life.
Yeah.
So you are Lauren A, like capital A,
yeah.
McAfee, and that's McAfee. So on Twitter and Instagram, that is how they can find you.
You got it.
Okay.
McAfee.
All right. Well, and a closing question, since this is the Uniquely Beautiful Stories podcast, and sometimes we talk about things that are pretty deep and kind of serious, I like to end with a light question and just ask you what is making your life beautiful right now. So it could be like a Starbucks drink. It could be a new shirt.
Coffee right now. I've had a lot. I'm full in on research and paper writing mode, which means lots of coffee to get me through the days.
I hear ya. And you know what? As we see you out and about over the next few days, we will remember that to pray for you and to offer you our good luck for the papers that y'all are writing.
That would be amazing.
Well, thank you again, Lauren. It's been so fun.
Thanks.
You're welcome. And listeners, Lauren and I hope that you're encouraged, and we would love for you to go out today and live your one uniquely beautiful story.
Thank you for listening to Uniquely Beautiful Stories with Heather McAneer. Share this podcast with a friend and subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Now go live your own story.